Georgia's DBHDD is warning all Georgians that half of all opioid deaths happen at home, when people take an Oxy or a Perc with a glass of alcohol for stress or to sleep. Learn more about protecting families from opioid overdoses at opioidresponse.info.
It's time for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thank you for joining us for today's show. Very quickly, before I introduce the panel and we begin the discussion about the top political stories in the news today, I want to do a little bit of backtracking about the show we did yesterday when I talked with the best-selling crime author, Karen Slaughter, whose new book is called False Witness. I heard from a number of you who said you were eager to read the book, that you really enjoyed the conversation. I did too. It occurred to me after the show is over that maybe I should have mentioned one quick thing. If you are thinking about reading the book because you heard the show, but you're not a fan of fairly graphic violence, you might want to pass it up on it. Karen Slaughter is very good at describing kind of bone-crunching, blood-shattering episodes of violence, and this book certainly contains them. So just a little caution, although I still think the book is enormous fun. All right. Again, I appreciated hearing from so many of you about it. You can listen to the show on our podcast or at gpb.org/PR if you missed it yesterday. Tamar Hallerman is joining us. It's Tuesday, the day that we have her, the senior reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, with us. Tamar, how are you?
Hey, I'm going to be skipping that true crime novel you just described. I am super squeamish, so that sounds like my nightmare.
Yeah, not true crime. It is a novel, so thank goodness it's not true crime. Hey, Tamar, you said right before the show went on, when we were talking, you've been kind of on the 96 Olympic beat fairly recently and have a couple of stories coming up during this 25th anniversary year since the Atlanta Olympics.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too ahead of myself on all of this, but something that Bill and I were talking about ahead of the show is today is a very noteworthy, sad anniversary. 25 years ago today, it was the ninth day of the Atlanta Olympics, and it's when a bomb tore through Centennial Olympic Park and killed a woman from Albany and spread terror throughout the city of Atlanta. So a very sad moment for the city.
Yeah, Eric Rudolph, of course, eventually arrested and tried for that crime. Richard Jewell, the security guard, was under suspicion for a long time before he was exonerated. Amelia Brock, our senior producer, back in those days was working, or not in those days, but was working before coming to us on our show on Second Thought, and she pointed out to me this morning that they did a story about a documentary about what they called the real Richard Jewell, and they won a Public Media Journalists Association Award in 2020 for that. And I know Amelia's very proud of that. We're also joined today by State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, Democrat from Decatur. Mary Margaret, how's your summer going?
It's going great. Thank you, Bill. I'm enjoying watching the Olympics, and there are many happy memories, some unhappy memories of 96, but a lot of happy memories about going to so many events then. I'm a fan, and I'm enjoying them this week.
Well, yeah, I haven't watched, you know, my wife and I were saying we haven't watched any of it because we've just seen sort of, it sort of is existing in this space where there are no spectators there. Has that made it a little more, a little less fun for you, Mary Margaret?
The NBC and the other broadcasters, I think, are doing interesting things about simultaneously filming the family. And last night, a 17-year-old from Seward, Alaska, where they have one swimming pool, won a gold medal. So they had a simultaneous film of the entire 2,000 people of Seward going absolutely crazy when she won. It was a fun way to kind of experience it for her, with her family and with Seward there with her by film. So it's a combination of different kind of approaches. But the athletes are there, and the athletes are amazing to me.
Well, thank you for that, filling us in on that. Edward Lindsay is back with us today, former Atlanta State Representative, a Republican, now the head of the government relations, the Georgia government affairs team at Denton's Edward, the world's largest law firm. How are you?
Very well. And thank you for having me. And like Margaret, I'm actually a big fan of the Olympics and usually watching.
We're still having a little, Edward, unfortunately your audio is continuing to break up a little bit. We were having a problem with it before the show, but Sam Burmistaz will work on getting it back. Kurt Young is back with us, professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Kurt, as we were getting set to go on the air, you said you were trying to squeeze out a little bit of enjoyment these last couple of weeks before school starts again.
And I tell you, Bill, the closer the semester gets, the shorter the time feels that you have to really enjoy, right? Even though it says 2 weeks, it feels more like 2 days to work with. But you know, Bill, I wanted to share something with you, a little known fact that I don't think you and I talked about. You know, I was on the Mayor's Blue Ribbon Commission to investigate that bombing, the Olympic bombing. Yeah, I was a member of that commission. I took part in all of the research components, everything from the ride-alongs to the interviewing of the operators at the 911 call center, to looking at the GIS aspects, the timeline. One of my main tasks was to organize that timeline from the time that the call went in to the time that the actual bomb detonated. I've been reflecting on it these last few days as well.
That must have been a fascinating experience to be a part of that commission. I'm glad you shared that with us.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. I want to start the show tomorrow by talking about a story that's on the front page of your newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this morning. The headline is Fulton Elections Takeover Mulled. Mark Nisi and Ben Brash were the reporters on the story. And here's just a little of what they wrote. With a rising drumbeat of criticism, several Republican Georgia legislators are building a case for the state government to take over Fulton County elections. The newfound power to fire local elections management created by Georgia's voting law worries voting rights advocates who say it could be abused for partisan purposes to tamper with the heavily Democratic county. Now, to some extent, this the notion of a takeover is still off somewhere in the distance, possibly. The ground seems to be being laid for that possibility, but we don't know unequivocally that that's where we're headed quite yet, Tamar.
Yeah, exactly. So under the new law that was passed earlier this year, the state election board can replace a county election board after a performance review, an audit, or an investigation. And that gives a temporary superintendent authority over things like vote counting, polling places, and staffing. And you're right, Bill. It is hard to know exactly what's going on. Fulton County has long been a punching bag for pretty much everyone, not just Republicans. I feel like inevitably on election night every year, everyone on Twitter is talking about how Fulton is once again delayed and slow and messy. But at the same time, it's hard to ignore the kind of escalating comments from a lot of Republicans who've indicated that, yeah, they might want to see some sort of investigation. And, you know, you certainly hear from Democrats from Fulton who are extremely worried about that possibility.
Mary Margaret, the Senate pro tem, Butch Miller, is, of course, running for lieutenant governor, but he is considering calling for a performance review of how Fulton County dealt with ballots in the 2020 election. State Senator Burt Jones, another possible candidate for lieutenant governor, wants to hold legislative hearings. And Mary Margaret, we know that David Ralston, the speaker, has proposed a GBI investigation of the Fulton County practices. And as I throw it to you, I think it's important to underline what Tamar just said. The concerns about a partisan takeover are relevant for Democrats, but it is true that Fulton County's election processes have been chaotic for years.
The messaging that's going on from the Republican leadership to stake out political ground is going to go on for a good while. This time last year, in 2020, the House was conducting one of the many investigations that have been called for in a variety of ways about the 2020 June primary and the November and the January 2021. The messaging that is using the House 202 bill is politics. It's very, very little substance there, as we've seen by a dozen lawsuits and a dozen other press conferences and ongoing quote-unquote investigations. The Speaker sent out a letter last week that called for something at Fulton County. The Senate responds this week with actions about Fulton County. It's a reliable punching bag that is ongoing and is going to continue, I think, throughout the election cycle.
Yeah, I agree with that. It connects with a trend in Fulton County, right? As you mentioned yourself, Bill, Fulton County has had problems. But there are different stars aligning now, or I guess we could say realigning. Remember, this is not happening in a vacuum. It's happening in the context of Georgia politics. It's happening in the context of Atlanta politics. And it's happening within the framework of Atlanta being a base, once again, for civil rights-related struggles, civil rights-related, social justice-related ground-level organizing and demonstration. And it's happening against the backdrop of the extent to which the state of Georgia in general and Fulton County in particular delivered in the most recent election. So part of what I'm watching here is the extent to which a question is answered. Where is this actually heading? And I think that although it's being framed within the discourse around voting irregularities or elections irregularities, it can easily become a matter of national politics as it relates to mobilizing of the black vote, mobilizing of other communities of color who themselves may feel threatened by what appears to be unsupported claims with regard to the access to the ballot and the use of the vote as a means of empowerment. I think this is going to be headed into some major social and political mobilization on the ground.
To pick up on what some other folks have said before, in a bipartisan fashion, folks in Fulton County have been, and statewide, have been frustrated with Fulton County Election Board for a long time. I mean, it's often been referred to as a lost island of misfit toys in terms of its administration. The problem here is that it's getting politicized as a result of the unproven claims of voter fraud. People aren't willing to take seriously the very serious problems with to the administration of the election systems within Fulton County and some other counties as well. And hopefully that's where the focus will go to as we go down the road. I will say this. The threat of a takeover is oftentimes a very important thing to have. Mary Morgan and I served in the General Assembly when the General Assembly gave the governor the power to relieve school boards of their positions if they proved dysfunctional. And this was particularly important after the APS scandal in 2010. The threat of that led to the APS board, quite frankly, shaping up and coming back into compliance in many ways. So, you know, I think the threat here may be as important as actually ever pulling the trigger.
When are the voters going to become tired of the messaging from either side? And that's what I think about. If it's a daily argument from Republicans, and I'm sure Ed will say it, it's true in some ways from Democrats too, that our message for 2022 elections is about election fraud or election stealing or election integrity. When are the voters going to get tired of that? I know I'm already tired of it, and I'm in the middle of it and care a lot about it. The 202 attacks through the lawsuits are going to continue. The political posturing is going to continue. And it's going to result in my guesswork, educated guesswork, in no action. Because the action to actually take over Fulton County, given no evidence, which is what we understand to be true, is going to create such a backlash that I don't think that's a risk that the Republicans will take. The messaging of the Democrats is about they're coming after us to generate turnout. The message of the Republicans are, we're coming after you to generate turnout. When is that going to become really tiresome to the voter and the leaders running for office, or the leaders substantively? When are they going to figure out that they really got to talk about something that people care about, and that is crime or mental health or education lagging or other things that are really more meaningful to people than political posturing?
Yeah, that's an important point. But I suspect that one of the responses to that frustration will be, as I kind of said a moment ago, would be a certain level of mass mobilization. In other words, the history of voter disenfranchisement is so recent. You know, we talk about the 1960s and 50s as if it was ancient history. It's really not that long ago. And when you have a younger generation now who is becoming much more politically acclimated, they're becoming more politically conscious, more politically engaged, of course, are never at the level that we as elders would want them to, right? In the spirit of young people voting. But the issue is something that they can easily respond to, right? This notion that the vote is being threatened, the franchise is being threatened. And it can be that issue that mobilizes a whole generation, especially, Bill, as this becomes more of a national story, right? We're talking about the state of Georgia. It could easily become a national story, as what we've seen happen here in Georgia can be duplicated in other places where the similar laws are unfolding.
Edward, jump in.
Well, the fact of the matter is, to sort of build on what Mary Margaret said as well as Kurt, is that one of the most important things in a democracy is for the losers to respect the outcome, to be able to say, you know, we'll come back in 2 years, but you are my governor, or you are my president, or you are my representative, or whatever else. That is a central cornerstone of a democratic system, is to have the loser accept the outcome and then move on. We've had a disturbing trend in this country over the last few years of the losers not respecting the outcome and questioning the outcome. The fact of the matter is we have a relatively secure election system in this country, a lot better than we had in the past. We have more people participating in our democracy than ever before. That's a good thing. And that we need to, both sides need to be focusing on things that will allow their base to respect the outcome and to focus on
Tamar,
that. And also allow the other side to respect the outcome should they prevail.
I apologize for interrupting, Edward. Tamar, before we leave this subject, I do think it's important to point out that Mary Margaret is dubious about whether the Republican-controlled legislature would ever move ahead with replacing an election of board. But the new voting law, Senate Bill 202, does in fact create a situation in which the state election board could replace a county election board after a performance review, which is being called for by some Republicans, an audit or an investigation, which David Ralston is calling for from the GBI of Fulton County's election practices, and they could install a temporary superintendent who would have full authority over vote counting in polling places and staffing. So Mary Margaret may be right that voters eventually are going to get tired of this messaging, but that doesn't mean Republicans couldn't actually use the language of this bill, this law, to in fact start replacing some election officials in counties like Fulton that tend to vote Democratic.
Yeah, and you're starting to see some rhetoric from voting rights activists and some Democrats who are concerned that, you know, this temporary superintendent, the person put in place, may never want to certify whatever election results come in, no matter what happens. I think at this point, some of that is just fear. We don't really quite know yet. I think kind of the big problem right now is that so many conspiracy theories have kind of taken hold about what exactly happened in Fulton. But there are some legit problems that we also saw in 2020 in the county. And I wonder how much of that is going to get lost in all of this. We saw lines stretching for hours in Midtown in the primary last June. Some people were waiting 3, 4, 5, 6 hours to vote. Some voters never got their absentee ballots that they requested. That's getting drowned out by conspiracy theories, you know, about videos with election workers pulling ballot containers from under a table. And I think the problem is that people are becoming so galvanized one way or another that I don't think, I think some of these smaller things that are still huge, polling places getting consolidated, absentee ballots not arriving, that's going to get lost.
Well,
Edward and then Mary Margaret, let me ask a question. I'm sorry, Edward, but I want to ask you and Mary Margaret to each offer your opinions on this. Why can't Fulton County's election board get its act together? They have been struggling with one crisis after another for decades. Tamara just pointed at some of it out. Lines that extend for blocks, people waiting hours to vote. There's no excuse for a county like Fulton, Edward, and then Mary Margaret to not be able to straighten all this out.
That is a source of frustration for years. And having been one of those individuals who was stuck in a line when suddenly the machines broke down, for a long period of time with no real explanation, so I was one of those people that had been frustrated by that. And it's an open question as to why. But hopefully, maybe the threat will start to get folks to wake up. And I would also want to add one last point to my Republican friends of caution here, is what I call the Pottery Barn rule, which is you break it, you own it. And same thing is, it's one thing to threaten, it's one thing to cajole, it's one thing to send in the GBI and other experts to try to get them to improve how they're doing things. It's another thing to take over, because once you take over, you own the mistakes. And so that's going to be a question that I think the Republicans have to ask themselves in terms of whether or not to actually pull the trigger.
Across the state, we know that precincts don't open on time. We know that machines are broken. And we know that there are lines. When you have 900,000 people in Fulton County with a more changeable population, the Fulton County Election Board did not do before June 2020 what they needed to do about reassigning precincts. The 6 or 8 hour wait at the Park Tavern precinct in Midtown was a disaster and was a management error. They have their faults. As across the state, thousands of precincts run by essentially volunteers in a locally managed operation. Fulton County has its problems trying to provide election for 900,000 people in a changing, very strongly changing population. That's not an excuse that it's hard what they do, not an excuse at all. But there is no fraud. There is no illegality. The voting counting was accurate, and they're going to have to struggle and have to do better on precincts to alignment to prevent hours and hours of waiting.
I've got to get to a break, but Mary Margaret, does the law, that's the new law, require that there be some evidence of fraud before they could, the legislature can, it doesn't require that, does it?
No, and this posturing that's going on about from both the House and the Senate leadership that we're going to do X or Y is laying out a paper trail that for them to continue to wave the threat. We're in charge, you're not competent. We're in charge, you're not competent, and people need to be afraid of you. That's the message that they're going to continue to send, and it's very unfortunate in our view.
Okay, I've got to get to the first break of the show. When we come back, I want to talk about one more election story in the news, and then we got to talk about the COVID pandemic that seems to be stepping up here in Georgia. How are state officials and local officials dealing with it? That and a lot more after these messages. Mary Margaret Oliver, Edward Lindsay, Kurt Young, Tamar Hallerman with me today. Tamar, in what has become a not infrequent occurrence, yesterday, Politico, the national political newspaper, featured Georgia on its homepage with a headline that we can't repeat on the radio, but it essentially suggested that Democrats are terrified of what could happen in the 2022 election cycle with the election laws being passed in a number of Republican-controlled states, including Georgia. And here's the lead. After Georgia Republicans passed a restrictive voting law in March, Democrats here began doing the math. The state's new ID requirement for mail-in ballots could affect more than 270,000 Georgians lacking identification. The provision cutting the number of ballot drop boxes could affect hundreds of thousands of voters who cast absentee ballots that way in 2020, and that's just in the populous Atlanta suburbs alone. And Democrats here are trying to figure out how to counter that, Tamar.
Yeah, the story kind of shows how much hand-wringing there is among Democrats, not only in Georgia, but nationally, about the impact of laws like SB 202. And I think the the takeaway from this article is no one has a really good answer. I mean, the best case scenario is they can get turnout like what they did in the presidential election last fall. That's going to be really hard without a presidential race at the top of the ballot to generate excitement. And I think there's a fear among Democrats of, you know, I think one of them in the story described it as death by a thousand cuts, all the different provisions in a lot of these laws like SB 202 and how, you know, even if one provision maybe prevents a couple hundred or a couple thousand people from voting, when you're talking about margins as close as 12,000, like Joe Biden's victory in Georgia this fall, Democrats are worried that could be more than enough to keep them in the minority.
So, Kurt, that leads to what's been an interesting debate going on among Democrats right now. There are some Democrats who have become very critical of the fact that President Biden is talking the talk about his dismay over state election laws that some believe are going to suppress the vote of Democratic voters, but that he's not taking enough action. He's not using the bully pulpit. And the response to that has been, like with organizations like Fair Fight, what we've got to do is mobilize to get people to get their voter IDs. We've got to do everything in our power to point out how people have to get out there and respond to this election law. But there's a debate back and forth about that, Kurt.
That's right. And I suspect that you'll have both unfolding, right? On the one hand, you will see there is no choice in Democratic politics right now around mobilizing as a response to what's taking place on the ground throughout the nation. There's no other choice. And so you're beginning to see that now. You're beginning to see, I'm very proud to see so many women take the lead in beginning this direct action type of organizing. That is major, and I think we're going to see more of that. But that's at the national level. That most recent story was at the national level. You're going to begin to see this mobilization unfold at the local levels as a part of a messaging. I think Tamar was mentioning a moment ago the messaging that's going to be associated with the current politics of the day. However, there's also going to be tremendous pressure, I think, placed on the administration and some of the more centrist Democrats who are taking a position to seek out higher levels of bipartisanship, which, it makes sense in the normal scheme of things, but something is different now that's requiring a different level of pressure to be placed on the administration in general and, for example, on senators such as Manchin in West Virginia, those who are looking for ways to find some middle ground. And I believe you're going to find, I keep making this point about the easy messaging. One of the targets of this pressure point, I think, will be a new focus on reforming, adjusting, maybe not outright eliminating the filibuster. That's going to become an instrument in the discussions around how to mobilize, I think, Democratic voters to respond to this issue.
I am dismissive, perhaps it's too strong a word, of the impact of messaging, but I am very concerned about the substance of 202 as it creates small but existing but reality-based barriers. We know that there were 20,000 provisional voters who exercised their right to vote provisionally last year, and in Fulton County, I think there were 3,000. The elimination under 202 of provisional ballots was very significant to me, and the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court made some ruling about provisional ballots to uphold a dumb move that Arizona made is troubling to me. Provisional ballots and drop boxes and IDs are substantive barriers for X number of people, primarily young people. The question I ask folks who want to help that are concerned about the reality is, how many 18 to 24-year-olds do you know who do not have a driver's license? They may have an Emory picture ID, which is no good. They may have a Morehouse picture ID that's no good, but do they have a driver's license or a state-issued picture ID? As a practical suggestion that I make everywhere I go, find the 18 to 25-year-olds in your immediate vicinity and make sure they have a picture ID. There are barriers that 202 creates, and getting the vote out is what won under the Stacey Abrams model in 2020. And it has to be replicated and has to be upgraded even more.
Edward?
Well, regardless of what you think of 202, the fact of the matter is that we have two political parties in the state who are very good at turning out their voters. And with 18 months from the time in which 202 was passed until the November election, I have every anticipation, quite frankly, that both parties will do a very good job getting their base out and getting the folks that they know are going to be supporting them out to vote. And that's going to be the key. The courts will handle whether or not there's any kind of undue burdens that are being placed on voters as a result of 202. Voting Rights Act still exists in terms of those kind of cases, and that's going to be considered over the next few months by the courts. But in the meantime, Stacey Abrams' organizations know how to work the system. And I mean that in a very positive form. Republicans know how to work the system. And I have every anticipation that both sides will be able to get their voters out. There may be new hurdles and changing of the rules that take place. But the question is, are they going to be unable to get the people out? And quite frankly, I expect both sides to be able to do so.
Tamar, to put a finishing point on this part of our discussion, the Politico piece points out that the state Democratic Party is confronting the new law by building on their voter education programs, which, as Edward Lindsay really pointed out, really were established after the 2018 midterm. Stacey Abrams and her organization, a big part of that. They're training county chairs, volunteers, and voters on the law's terms. The goal is to train volunteers on how to obtain a voter ID in all of Georgia's 159 counties. They've also brought on 3 new deputy political directors for Black, Latino, and Asian American outreach. So they're ramping up. And, you know, Alan Abramowitz on this show has said any number of times he thinks there's going to be great backlash to SB 202. He thinks it's going to motivate Democrats to turn out in big numbers.
Yeah, and we don't know what the news cycles are going to be in November 2022. So, you know, sure, right now there's so much anger among Democrats about SB 202. And yeah, it's going to take some work to kind of make sure that their voters are still going to be riled up leading into November. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
All right, why don't we do this? We want to turn the page and talk a bit about COVID in the next segment of the show. So why don't we get the final break of the show out of the way a little early and come back and we'll look at what's going on with the Delta variant in Georgia and how it's being responded to. You're listening to Political Rewind. We know that the coronavirus is once again active. I've been hesitant to use words like surge, spiking, because I want to be careful about the language I use around it, but it is certainly true that we are seeing an escalating number of positive COVID-19 cases in the state of Georgia, up something like 30% in just the last 30 days. Just this week, Savannah Mayor Van Johnson reimposed a mask mandate. Remember that he became the first mayor last year to impose a mask mandate, even before Governor Kemp came along and forbade, under his emergency power, cities from declaring mask mandates. Van Johnson said, we've got to do it. He kept that mandate in force until, I think, May of this year, and now he's reinstated it. Let's listen to just a little bit of what he had to say about the virus in Savannah.
During the past month, increased interactions among members of the public have resulted in an increased number of new daily COVID-19 cases here in Savannah, Chatham County. Daily cases are on a steep and alarming rise. Based on the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention indicators and thresholds, community transmission of COVID-19 within Savannah, Chatham County is now considered high and highly likely to increase during the coming days and weeks.
Tamar, just to put some data around his statement, there are now 230 cases of community transmission in Savannah. That's based on using a baseline of 100,000 residents, 230. But on July 9th, that community transmission index was at 76. Things are getting out of control, and we're still looking to see how the state is going to respond. Tamar?
Yeah, and so far what we've seen from the governor is that he doesn't want to change any of the guidance from the state. He never imposed a statewide mandate for masks. And after initially fighting with Mayor Johnson last year over Savannah's mask mandate, he and, of course, Keisha Lance Bottoms here in Atlanta, he ended up backing off of that fight and kind of letting cities do their thing. He's indicated he doesn't see a need for change at the moment, but the numbers certainly are startling. I mean, the 7-day rolling average yesterday was at its highest point since March, before most of us had gotten vaccinated. So that certainly is troubling, especially when you hear about cases of breakthrough infections from people who have been vaccinated. So it'll be interesting to see how this debate unfolds. I mean, certainly in Washington, you see stories about how the Biden administration is wrestling with what to do, especially when it comes to reimposing mask mandates. Of course, the issue has just become so politicized, and I think the fear is that they may overstep and make it even harder to get extra people vaccinated. So we'll see if other, especially here in Georgia, if other cities follow suit and do what Savannah is doing as well.
Edward, the last time I looked at the Georgia DPH, Department of Public Health, data on COVID, it was July 22nd. So it's been a few days now. But on that date, there were 1,440 new cases of COVID reported, compared to on June 27th, not even a month earlier, 192 new cases. And Edward, as I give the ball to you on this, Governor Kemp did, in fact, put out a video last week, which we played a portion of on our show, and he did point out that he's been vaccinated. He believes vaccines are making him safer, but he continues to be a little cautious about how he frames whether people should all be vaccinated. He says, that's your choice. You have to decide. And the question is that a strong enough message right now? Edward?
Open question. My friend, while I have a lot of respect for the governor, I'm kind of leaning more toward Governor Ivey from Alabama's position, which is it's getting close to the time when we start specifically blaming those who've chosen not to be vaccinated for the spike, which scientifically is correct. And I think that we need to start being tougher on our friends and neighbors and loved ones who've chosen not to be vaccinated, to go, hey, it's not simply a matter of my body, my choice. You are threatening the health of our state. You're threatening the economic viability of our state. You're threatening the rest of our ability to start living a more normal life. And I think that that's a message that I think folks need to be conveying at the top politically and all the way down to the kitchen table. Okay, enough's enough. If you're not being vaccinated, you're part of the problem, period. End of subject, end of story. Get vaccinated so we can start living a more normal life and we can protect people's lives.
Yes, the governor should tell people they should be vaccinated. The pandemic, hospitalizations, and deaths are among the unvaccinated. And it's very frightening to see the decisions people are making that are so destructive to families and to individuals. It's really tragic. So I think a stronger voice, which I'm hearing from a number of the national Republicans, yes, you should get vaccinated. Do not waste your young life. The other group of people that, as we go towards school starting, is children under 12. Why did that five-year-old in Calhoun die? I mean, I know there's only a dozen or so children that have died of COVID, but the parents I talked to about their children going back to school would really prefer all their children to be vaccinated. And I think we're 6 months away from that, or we're some number of months away from that. So this the reality of the pandemic is ongoing. People are dying. People who are unvaccinated are the ones that are filling our hospitals, and the people that are dying. And the questions still exist about children and the safety of children. The other reality that I'm reading about affects probably all of us as we're talking amongst ourselves this morning, and that is, what's the incidence of breakthrough virus for those of us that have been vaccinated? If all of us are vaccinated, which may be true on this panel, what's the likelihood of a breakthrough virus for me or for you, Bill, because we're kind of probably the older folks in this crowd? We do know that if the breakthrough virus comes to me, I'm not going to have to go to the hospital, and it's not going to be life-threatening because I have been vaccinated. But what is the extent that I should be worried about breakthrough virus for myself, given my age and condition? So there's realities of the pandemic that are simply not over yet, and I would like to see a stronger leadership from all of our Republican leaders. Yes, you should get vaccinated. Do not throw your life away. Get the vaccine.
Kurt, there's obviously been a lot of attention focused on the partisan divide on vaccines, that typically in many states, it is the red counties of the states. Republicans who are supporters of Trump have decided not to get vaccinated. But it is also true, Kurt, that there has been a continuing effort to try to get the African-American community vaxxed up, so to speak, that there is still hesitation. And despite the efforts of, say, the Morehouse School of Medicine, Valerie Montgomery Rice, the president of that institution, to do mobilizations out in the community, it continues to be a struggle, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, the ghost of Tuskegee still haunts us, right? And by that I mean the infamous Tuskegee experiment, where significant numbers of African-American men were unknowingly given some of the most virulent forms of a disease. I don't remember exactly which one, but it without them knowing, and through the relationship with a health official. And so there's been this long-standing suspicion in the Black community with regard to these kind of medical types of efforts. However, I think, though, despite that, there is an increasing sensibility to what we're dealing with now, because this is different, right? This is a global pandemic, and it's ravaging the entire planet, although we can find some positive results among African-Americans who have been vaccinated. There is a suspicion. But then there's also segments of the Black community, Bill, that are, and I don't think this is unique to the Black community, but there are segments of the population that are not getting access to the information that we all digest on a daily basis, right? And then you add to that the impact of situations around poverty and what have you. It becomes a really serious challenge. And this is why it's directly connected to the politics at the local level, right? Because it needs to be a very carefully structured messaging that goes to the Black community that may be different from other communities within the society?
Well, Edward, you know, to go back to my original point, the frustration here is that, unlike some other countries that are struggling to have enough vaccines to vaccinate all their people, we have enough vaccines to vaccinate all of our people. One of the things that Donald Trump did right, I know there's a lot of reason for criticism, but one thing he did right was he pushed the vaccination program so that this country would have enough vaccines. By contrast, the tragedy that you see, for instance, in many parts of Africa are countries that are starving for the vaccines in order to save their people's lives. But here in the United States, we have the ability to save everyone if everyone will simply do the right thing.
Tamar, this becomes a particularly urgent matter because schools are going to start again, in some cases, next week. DeKalb County here in metro Atlanta goes back, I think, on August 2nd. The Atlanta Public Schools have already said they're going to require masks when they start classes a little bit later. And there are places like Cobb County where there are fights going on between school administrators and parents over masking. A lot of parents saying, don't make our kids wear masks. But this is more urgent because of the school openings that are about to happen.
Yeah, of course. And I'm not sure exactly where the big pharmaceutical companies are in terms of testing vaccines. I know they are under pressure to start looking at the effects of kids 5 to 12 right now. I believe it's 12 and over who can get vaccinated. But until then, and I think as Mary Margaret said, you know, that could take months before that stuff is approved. So yeah, of course, this has become political like everything else. I do think it'll be interesting to see the impact. We have a bunch of private universities in Georgia that are mandating that their students get vaccinated, including many of the HBCUs, as well as Emory, whereas the university system of Georgia is not. And I'm going to be very curious to see what the data looks like after that, or if there are dips in attendance in a lot of these schools from people who can't or don't want to get the vaccine. And as Kurt said, we're only a couple weeks away, so there's not the most time left.
Yeah, the problem is that a lot of the schools that universities that are requiring vaccines are not getting compliance from students, according to data we're looking at. And so that's a problem as well. Mary Margaret, before we completely run out of time, you're concerned about a different aspect of school openings next week. It's related to the coronavirus in some ways, but you are concerned about how federal relief money is going to be used in the most positive ways in terms of, as you pointed out in a note you wrote to me, say in a DeKalb County school system. Tell us what you're concerned about.
I've been pestering the budget leaders and the budget staff folks about the 39,000 children that did not enroll for school in September 2020. How many of those, we typically have a 5 to 20,000 child increase in our 1.7 million children in K through 12. Last year, because of the pandemic, 39,000 children were down. Where did they go? Every school system is required to submit a plan to get its CARES money and rescue money to how it's going to spend it. And I am very concerned about the quality, quantitative data that will be accumulated by small and large. And I have three school districts in my district, a small one, Decatur, and a large one, 100,000 with DeKalb. Are they going to efficiently evaluate children who come to school? What educational loss or gain did they have since the last testing? And how are they going to provide remediation? The summer programs have been played out very differently. APS had a robust, extensive summer school program, and it accommodated about 40% of the APS school population. DeKalb County did not have a robust summer program with its federal money. It was kind of a normal 10-15%. DeKalb County's view about helping children pick up the gaps that they may have suffered last year comes from a longer period of time. Very complex.
I'm glad you raised that issue. Sam, Amelia, and I are working on putting together a special edition for next week about issues surrounding school openings in the state, and that'll be a great thing to add to our agenda. Real quick, Kurt, we don't have time to talk about it, but your university, Clark Atlanta University, has announced it is forgiving the debt. It is clearing the balance sheets of all the students who were in virtual classes all last year and through this year because they wanted to thank them and reward them for staying dedicated. I think Spelman College has joined that effort. So, Kurt, we wanted to give a shout-out to your university for that decision. All right, we're completely out of time. Kurt Young, Edward Lindsay, Mary Margaret Oliver, Tamar Hallerman, thank you for as always with you four on the panel, a really fascinating conversation. We're going to be back, of course, with another show tomorrow. Until then, take care. Stay safe and healthy. Unfortunately, start thinking about wearing a mask more often again. And if for some reason you're not vaccinated, it really is time to take it seriously. Please help all of us, yourselves, your families, go out and get a vaccine. It's an easy thing to do. See y'all tomorrow.